Well, we made it through Friday night. I'm sure many of you just huddled around the television set to watch the ball drop at Times Square in New York City. Because everything important happens in New York City or Washington, D.C., but New York City has a great sense, I think, of self-importance. More so than London has, but London has more reason. Of course, London has an awful mayor as well. But as the ball drops, there's the familiar tune with the unfamiliar words that were sung and mumbled once again, attempted by those even singing through Mass, Auld Lang Syne. You know it as the song that everybody knows the first line but doesn't know the rest. It was written originally in a language called Scots, which is an old form of English that's basically unrecognizable to modern English speakers. The title literally means old, long since. It's been changed to a contemporary sounding for old time's sake. Now, some, probably very few, this is going to be probably one of those that's just me, but might remember the Ed Sullivan Show. Some of you might remember the Ed Sullivan Show. Well, there's a comedian that used to be on the Ed Sullivan Show called Alan Sherman, who would do takeoffs on popular songs. He did that song about Camp Granada. You might remember Hello Mother, Hello Father. But he also came on New Year's Eve and sang this: I know a man whose name is Lang, and he has a neon sign. And Mr. Lang is very old, so they call it Old Lang's sign. What we sing today is not what was originally written. We sing an updated version. Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and Auld Lang Syne? For Auld Lang Syne, my Joe, for Auld Lang Syne, we'll take a cup of kindness yet for Auld Lang Syne. And surely you'll be your pint stop and surely I'll be mine. And we'll take a cup of kindness yet for Auld Lang Syne. A cup of kindness, a sharing of a traditional beverage among friends, performing a toast. And in Scotland, you can pretty much understand what that beverage is going to be. It's good to look back. It's good to remember. It's good to reconnect. It's good to reflect. Even to become, if you will, nostalgic. What is nostalgia? It's a sentimental longing or wistful affection for the past, typically for a period or place with happy personal associations. So a sentimental longing or wistful affection for the past, typically for a period or place with happy personal associations. In our day and time, it's not unusual for us to feel nostalgic for 2019. It's possible even for children to feel nostalgic. And children saying, I remember a day when Mommy and Daddy didn't complain about the economy. Or I remember summer vacation. And here we are back in school. Or I remember when we used to go to school without masks. Or have plastic dividers in front of us, or various other things that children have had to endure this year and in the past. And when it comes to nostalgia, we have to be careful in regard to it. Sentimental longings for pet periods of our past sometimes that we recall those days differently than they actually were. Nostalgia, again, the positive God called upon the Israelites to remember the things as they actually were, things as they actually were in Egypt, and how they were delivered from that. And oddly, the Israelites, soon after they left Egypt, waxed nostalgic for cucumbers and onions that were in Egypt. As we come to Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verses 1 through 10, they form a whole section. And Solomon makes a series of statements in which he contrasts the difference between wisdom and folly, or wisdom and foolishness. And it sounds very much like the Proverbs, which would only make sense since Solomon wrote Proverbs as well. These are contrasts that at first might seem a bit harsh. Certainly seem to be lacking joy, yet when we consider them, we see the point being made, and that point makes good sense. Notice what he says in verse 1, a good name is better than precious ointment in the day of death than the day of one's birth. A good name to be highly sought after, that is to be known of having a good character. And that should be highly praised. But the second line might be troublesome. The day of death is better than the day of birth. But if we think what he's getting at here, it's this. Your character can only be established after your death. After your death, you can't sin anymore. After your death, you can't ruin what you spent your time building up. And if we go through the Old Testament, we can see plenty of those Old Testament saints who seem to start so well, but end not so good. After death, we cannot anymore ruin a good name or a good reputation or a good character. And then in verse 2, he says, better to go to the house of mourning then go to the house of feasting. As the end of all men and the living, take it to heart. He doesn't say don't go to the house of feasting. But he merely points out, in contrasting the settings which one is going to cause us to think, which setting is going to cause us to think even more on important matters? And he says, in verse 3, sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better. And the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. Sorrow is better than laughter. And if you think about that, he's not saying that we should be sorrowful all the time. That's not anything like he's talking about. But what he's getting at here is important, because even if we go to the Psalms, we see David constantly repeating the question, why art thou cast down, O my soul? He repeats that question. He's asking himself, and then he would answer it, hope thou in God. But he never says or never points to it, and you can never find it in the Psalms where he says, why art thou full of mirth and happiness, O my soul? Hope thou in God. It is the times that he's cast down that makes him think and wonder and cause him to grow. The wise man, as Benjamin Shaw wrote, the wise man thinks on serious things of life, whereas the fool is always looking to be distracted. Verse 5, it's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. Wise men seek to become better, while fools are only looking for what entertains them. Verse 6, for like the crackling of thorns under a pot, So is the laughter of a fool. This also is vanity. It gives us a profound picture. I have several sweet gum trees that are well over 30 feet in height. And every year they produce a bumper crop. They carpet the ground with these sweet gum balls. And if anybody ever comes up with a proper use for sweet gum balls, please let me know. I will furnish you with everything that you need for raw materials. But here's a case. You've got a fire here and a fire here. And in both cases, in both places, you need to heat a pot of water. So you put a bunch of sweet gum balls under one, and you put hickory wood under the other. Which is going to heat the water? The sweet gum balls are like thorns. They'll flare up, and they'll give you a beautiful little glowing fire for about 20 seconds. But the other will continue to bring forth. And that's what he says, the laughter of a fool. Well, the laughter of a fool generally is laughter that has no substance to it whatsoever. And that's the point he's making. Thorns don't last long enough to do what is necessary. And then verses 7 through 9, surely oppression destroys a man's reason, and a bribe debases the heart. In verse 7, there's a picture of extortion, and a wise man being extorted will not use the reason that he normally would have. And a bribe debases the heart. The end of a thing is better than its beginning. The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Do not hasten in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools. And then we come to where we will spend the rest of our time. Do not say, why were the former days better than these? For you do not inquire wisely concerning this. Why were the former days better than this? Now, up to this point, he's made all kinds of comparisons, but here he actually makes a command. Do not say this. If you wish to be considered wise, do not say, why were the former days better than these? Now, what is the main thought or action or attitude that he's pointing at? What he's pointing to is dissatisfaction. Dissatisfaction. That's what is at the heart of someone saying, what a good old days are better than these days. First, in this kind of mindset, we can entertain false ideas about the past. Secondly, it can be a statement of disappointment. Why am I having such a difficult time? Or thirdly, it can be a form of tunnel vision that sees only a small part of the present. You know, often people long for the past because of the felt a certain comfort at that time in the past that they do not feel today. It's a strange dichotomy that we have. We have people who say they don't care one fig about the past. And we have others who seem to live in the past. But yet the one who says, I have nothing to do with the past, I dislike the past, and I'm going to speak about the past, often will hearken back to things. Even the rank liberal will say, what wonderful days when George McGovern was running for president. Can't we return to the 70s? Here Solomon would warn us not to be caught up in some sort of victim mentality as well. Well, you know, my problem is I was born at the wrong time and in the wrong place. If
you're born, you think you're born at the wrong time, they're still Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
If you didn't get that, ask me later and we'll talk about it. But the idea of somehow I've been mistreated, and though not often vocalized, it is saying God didn't do something right, and somehow we deserve something better from God. And secondly, if we get into that mindset saying, my situation 5 years ago was much better than it is today. Again, this is a mentality of being put upon. I don't like the current situation. I want things back the way they were. These examples are from a faulty perspective, and bring God's providence, His goodness and His purpose into question. Now, someone might well ask, is it wrong for us to note and make notation of the fact that the times today do not seem as good as they were? And the answer to that is no, there's nothing wrong with that. We know from the words of our Lord, Matthew 24, and verses 9 through 12, He said that things would get worse. He never said, there's a golden age coming on the earth, friends. A time when everybody will get along and we'll just be having a happy time and it'll be just a wonderful thing. Not in this time. There is a time that will come, but it has to be a new heavens and a new earth where righteousness dwells. Remember what Paul told Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and in verse 1. But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power. He said, this is going to happen in the last days. Well, you look at that and say, well, what are the last days? The last days are from the time when Christ was ascended to the time that Christ returns. This is what we're going to face in these days. It's not a picture painted of happy times. It's not an intolerable time, but we should not be surprised when sometimes we see things seem to look like they're deteriorating. And some of this can be good in the fact that it would lead us, like Jeremiah writes in Lamentations 3 and verse 40, let us search out and examine our ways and turn back to God. Keep in mind, as we read in 2 Timothy chapter 3 just a moment ago, did Paul write, bear in mind in these last days, God is just going to walk away. Or God is going to cause all these bad things to happen in this world. No, what's the problem? What's making the days bad? Man's behavior. Man's behavior. That's why it's not good to grumble against God concerning the times. It's necessary for us to see that it is not our plan that's being worked out. It is God's. We don't have the heavenly wisdom. In Jeremiah chapter 12, Jeremiah chapter 12, verse 1, righteous are you, O Lord, when I plead with you. Yet let me talk with you about your judgments. Why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why are those happy who deal so treacherously? You have planted them, yet they have taken root.
They grow, yes, they bear fruit. You are near in their mouth, but far from their mind. But you, O Lord, know me. You have seen me, and you have tested my heart toward you. Pull them out like sheep for the slaughter, and prepare them for the day of slaughter. How long will the land mourn, and the herbs of every field wither, and the beasts and birds are consumed for the wickedness of those who dwell there, because they said, he will not see our final end. See, we don't know what it is that God is doing. We don't know his plan. And so that's why Jeremiah goes to him and he asks the questions. But it's also good to know, while we pine about the past, we very well may be missing so much present good. These have been a couple of very tough years. 20 and 21 are years that people look back on and say, these were times of great confusion and the people that we put our trust in failed us miserably. And in the end now, we've come to a point where it even looks like the president has said, well, there's nothing else to do. And everything the multitude of things they tried didn't do what they were seeking to do, because man can't do what he was seeking to do. And so we come into this year with a load of skepticism that we might not have had in prior years. And the worst thing about skepticism is it gets up. I remember a few years back, there had been a storm that went through New Orleans, and a few of the streets were flooded to the point that there was one person who was kayaking down one of the streets. Now, you understand, New Orleans is below sea level, so. And so here's the news camera, and it's focused on this person in the kayak. Over to the side, here's another person walking down the street. Not impeded, not up to their neck in water, but the camera focused on the kayak to the missing of the person who was unimpeded by the water. And that's what happens when we get into this mindset of looking for things that are wrong. We focus on the kayak and that's the flood, but when we look over here, it's not a flood. The camera can't do a panoramic. It can't do 360 degrees. It can only do what's right in front of it. And our minds get into that tunnel vision, and we see only that, and we miss all the other stuff that's going on that's really good. That's really fine. And so when we review the past and we see God's blessings in it, let us rejoice. Rejoice in the hope that the God who blessed us then is the same God today. That past blessings are really a confidence for the future and the present. But there's one other thing too. You know, turn a little bit Solomon-like on this. We're supposed to be very appreciative to God, giving us the place and the time in which we live and blessing us in which the time we live. We are to be thankful for every blessing we have in this world, but we are not to become infatuated with it and wholly and totally in love with it. That the difficulties and the things that we see around us should cause us to do as Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 1, for we know that if this earthly house This tent is destroyed. We have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed with our habitation, which is from a heaven, from heaven. If indeed, having been clothed, we shall not be found naked, for we who are in this tent groan, being burdened. Not because we want to be unclothed, but further clothed, that mortality may be swallowed up by life. Now he who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who has also given us the Spirit as a guarantee. One of the things that we rejoice about, if we can, if you think about it that way, when we see the troubles in this world, when they disturb us, it should, in a way, make us long for that which is to come and show us that we're not really fitted for this world. That we know that there's something better to come and God will bring it in His time. And so we know the past is wonderful in so many ways. But you know something about the past? You can't bring it back. Even when you try to recreate it, you can't recreate it the way it actually was. The past cannot be changed. And the past cannot be transformed. But hope transforms. And hope, rather than upsetting us, it anchors us. And so we do have this anchor for the soul. We do have a hope that cannot disappoint. A hope that is realized is no longer a hope, as Paul would say. But that which we hope for is ahead of us. And we are told that that which we hope for in Christ will never and cannot disappoint us. Perhaps maybe as we look at this year 2022, and we look at 2020, and we look at 2021, 2 years that have gone by with a blur, and people might be tempted to say, oh, I'd like to go back to the 60s. Turn the clock back 60 years. That's not me. I don't want to go back 60 years. Because I know with each and every day that passes, I am one day closer to the final stage of my salvation, to realizing the blessed hope. So rejoice in the past, see God's blessings in the past, rejoice in His goodness. But oh, that goodness of the past is going to pale in regard to what He holds for us in the future. Let's stand together for prayer.